yourself.
As she descended toward her father's nursery, she paused at the landing, contemplating longer and harder about going in to see him than she had on her way up. Pride had prevented her the first time, and now shame set her feet into motion once again, spiraling down away from him, chastising herself for thinking on the ghosts from her past that had long ago been banished from memory. At the 34th, the entrance to IT, she again considered stopping. There would be clues in Scotty's office, maybe even some they hadn't managed to scrub away. She shook her head. The conspiracies were already forming in her mind, and as hard as it was to leave the scene of the crime behind, she knew she wouldn't be allowed anywhere near his office. She continued down the staircase and thought, as she considered IT's location in the silo, that this couldn't be an accident either. She had another 32 floors to go before she checked in with the first deputy, who was located near the center of the mids. The sheriff's office was 33 floors above her head. IT, then, was as far as it could get from any deputy station in the silo. She shook her head at this paranoid thinking. It wasn't how diagnoses were made. Her father would have told her so. After meeting with the first deputy around noon and accepting a piece of bread and fruit along with a reminder to eat, she made good time down through the mids, wondering as she passed the upper apartments which level Lucas lived on, or if he even knew of her arrest. The weight of the past week seemed to pull her down the stairwell, gravity sucking at her boots, the pressures of being sheriff dissipating as she left that office far behind. Those pressures were slowly replaced with an eagerness to return to her friends, even in shame, as she got closer and closer to Mechanical. She stopped to see Hank, the down-deep deputy on level 120. She had known him for a long time, was becoming more and more surrounded with familiar faces, people who waved hello, their moods somber as if they knew every detail of her time away. Hank tried to get her to stay and rest a while, but she only paused long enough to be polite, to refill her canteen, and then to shuffle the remaining 20 floors to the place she truly belonged. Knox seemed thrilled to have her back. He wrapped her up in a crippling hug, lifting her feet off the ground and roughing up her face with his beard. He smelled of grease and sweat, a mix Juliet had never fully noticed in the down deep because she had never been free from it. The walk to her old room was punctuated by slaps on her back. Well wishes, questions about the up top, people calling her sheriff in jest, and the sort of rude frivolity she had grown up in and grown used to. Juliet felt more saddened by it all than anything. She had set out to do something and had failed. And yet her friends were just happy to have her back. Shirley, from second shift, spotted her coming down the hallway and accompanied Juliet on the rest of the walk to her room. She updated Juliet on the status of the generator and the output from the new oil well, as if Juliet had simply been on vacation for a short while. Juliet thanked her at the door to her room, stepped inside, and kicked her way through all the folded notes slipped under her door. She lifted the strap of her day pack over her head and dropped it, then collapsed onto her bed, too exhausted and upset at herself to even cry. She awoke in the middle of the night. Her small display terminal showed the time in green blocky numbers, 2:14 a.m. Juliet sat on the edge of her old bed in coveralls that weren't truly hers and took stock of her situation. Her life was not yet over, she decided. It just felt that way. Tomorrow, even if they didn't expect her to, she would be back at work in the pits, keeping the silo humming, doing what she did best. She needed to wake up to this reality, to set other ideas and responsibilities aside. Already they felt so far away. She doubted she would even go to Scotty's funeral, not unless they sent his body down to be buried where it belonged. She reached for the keyboard slotted into the wall rack. Everything was covered in a layer of grime, she saw. She had never noticed it before. The keys were filthy from the dirt she brought back from each shift. The monitor's glass was limned with grease. She fought the urge to wipe the screen and smear the shiny coat of oil around, but she would have to clean her place a little deeper, she decided. She was viewing things with untainted and more critical eyes. Rather than chase pointless sleep, she keyed the monitor awake to check the work logs for the next day, anything to get her mind off the past week. But before she could open her task manager, she saw that she had over a dozen wires in her inbox. She'd never seen so many. Usually people just slid recycled notes under each other's doors, but then she had been a long way away when the news of her arrest had hit, and she hadn't been able to get to a computer since. She logged onto her email account and pulled up the most recent wire. It was from Knox. Just a semicolon and a parenthesis. A half-chit smile. Juliet couldn't help it. She smiled back. She could still smell Knox on her skin, and realized, as far as the big brute was concerned, that all the troubles and problems percolating in whispers down the stairwell about her paled in comparison to her return. To him, the worst thing that had happened in the last week was probably the challenge of replacing her on first shift. Jules went to the next message, one from the third shift foreman welcoming her home, probably because of the extra time his crew was putting in to help cover her old shift. There was more. A day's pay of a note from Shirley, wishing her well on her journey. These were all notes they had hoped she would receive up top to make the trip down easier, hoping she wouldn't loathe herself and would know she shouldn't feel humiliated or even a failure. Juliet felt tears well up at how considerate it all was. She had an image of her desk, Holston's desk, with nothing but unplugged wires snaking across its surface, her computer removed. There was no way she could have gotten these messages when they were meant to be read. She wiped at her eyes and tried not to think of the wired notes as money wasted, but rather as extravagant tokens of her friendships in the down deep. Reading each one, trying to hold it together, made the last message she came to doubly jarring. It was paragraphs long. Juliet assumed it was an official document, maybe a list of her offenses, a formal ruling against her. She had only seen such messages from the mayor's office, usually on holidays, notes that went out to every silo member. But then she saw that it was from Scotty. Juliet sat straight up and tried to clear her head. She started from the beginning, damning her blurred vision.
"Jay, I lied. I couldn't delete this stuff. Found more. That tape I got you? Your joke was truth. And the program, not for a big screen. PXL density, not right. 32,768 by 8,192. Not sure what's that size. 8 inches by 2 inches? So many PXLs, if so. Putting more together. Don't trust porters, so wiring this. Screw cost. Wire me back. Need transfer to mech. Not C-Fear. S."
Juliet read it a second time, crying now. Here was the real voice of a ghost warning her of something, all of it too late. And it wasn't the voice of one who was planning his death. She was sure of that. She checked the timestamp of the wire. It was sent before she'd even arrived back at her office the day before, before Scotty had died. Before he had been killed, she corrected herself. They must have found him snooping, or maybe her visit had alerted them. She wondered what IT could see, if they could break into her wire account even. They must not have yet, or the message wouldn't be there, waiting for her. She leapt suddenly from her bed and grabbed one of the folded notes by the door. Digging a charcoal from her day pack, she sat back down on the bed. She copied the entire wire, every odd spelling, double-checking each number, and then deleted the message. She had chills up and down her arms by the time she finished, as if some unseen person was racing toward her, hoping to break into her computer before she dispensed with the evidence. She wondered if Scotty had been cautious enough to have deleted the note from his scent wires, and assumed, if he'd been thinking clearly, that he would. She sat back on her bed, holding the copied note, thoughts about the work log for the next day gone. Instead, she studied the sinister mess revolving around her, spiraling through the heart of the silo. Things were bad, from top to bottom. A great set of gears had been thrown out of alignment. She could hear the noise from the past week, this thumping and clanging, this machine lumbering off its mounts and leaving bodies in its wake. And Juliet was the only one who could hear it. She was the only one who knew. And she didn't know whom she could trust to help set things right, but she did know this. It would require a diminishing of power to align things once again. And there would be no way to call what happened next a holiday. 10. Juliet showed up at Walker's electronics workshop at 5, worried she might find him asleep on his cot, but smelling instead the distinctive odor of vaporized solder wafting down the hallway. She knocked on the open door as she entered, and Walker looked up from one of his many green electronics boards, corkscrews of smoke rising from the tip of his soldering iron.
"Jules!" he shouted.
He lifted the magnifying lens off his gray head and set it and the soldering iron down on the steel workbench.
"I heard you were back. I meant to send a note, but..."
He waved around at the piles of parts with their work order tags dangling from strings.
"Super busy," he explained.
"Oh, forget it," she said. She gave Walker a hug, smelling the electrical fire scent on his skin that reminded her so much of him and of Scotty. "I'm going to feel guilty enough taking some of your time with this," she said.
"Oh?"
He stepped back and studied her, his bushy white brows and wrinkled skin furrowed with worry.
"You got something for me?"
He looked her up and down for a broken thing, a habit formed from a lifetime of being brought small devices that needed repairing. "I actually just wanted to pick your brain." She sat down on one of his workbench stools, and Walker did the same.
"Go ahead," he said.
He wiped his brow with the back of his sleeve, and Juliet saw how old Walker had become. She remembered him without so much white in his hair, without the wrinkles and splotchy skin. She remembered him with his shadow. "It has to do with Scotty," she warned him. Walker turned his head to the side and nodded. He tried to say something, tapped his fist against his chest a few times, and cleared his throat.
"Damn shame,"
was all he could manage. He peered down at the floor for a moment. It can wait," Juliet told him, "if you need time."
"I convinced him to take that job,"
Walker said, shaking his head.
"I remember when the offer came, being scared he'd turn it down because of me, you know, that he'd be too afraid of me being upset at him for leaving, that he might just stay forever, so I urged him to take it."
He looked up at her, his eyes shining.
"I just wanted him to know he was free to choose. I didn't mean to push him away."
"You didn't," Juliet said. "Nobody thinks that, and neither should you."
"I just don't figure he was happy up there. That weren't his home."
"Well, he was too smart for us. Don't forget that. We always said that."
"He loved you,"
Walker said, and wiped his eyes.
"Damn, how that boy looked up to you."
Juliet felt her own tears welling up again. She reached into her pocket and brought out the wire she'd transcribed onto the back of the note. She had to remind herself why she was there, to hold it together.
"It just don't seem like him to take the easy way,"
Walker muttered. "No, it doesn't," she said. "Walker, I need to discuss some things with you that can't leave this room." He laughed, mostly, it seemed, to keep from sobbing.
"Like I ever leave this room," he said.
"Well, it can't be discussed with anyone else. No one, okay?" He bobbed his head. "I don't think Scotty killed himself." Walker threw up his hands to cover his face. He bent forward and shook as he started to cry. Juliet got off her stool and went to him, put her arms around his trembling back.
"I knew it,"
he sobbed into his palms.
"I knew it. I knew it. I knew it."
He looked up at her, tears coursing through several days of white stubble.
Who did this? They'll pay, won't they? Tell me who did it, Jules.
Whoever it was, I don't think they had far to travel, she said.
IT? God damn them!
Walker, I need your help sorting this out. Scotty sent me a wire not long before he... Well, before I think he was killed.
Sent you a wire?
Yeah. Look, I met with him earlier that day. He asked me to come down to see him.
Down to IT?
She nodded. I'd found something in the last sheriff's computer.
Austin.
He dipped his head.
The last cleaner. Yeah, Knox brought me something from you, a program, looked like. I told him Scotty would know better than anyone, so we forwarded it along.
Well, you were right. Walker wiped his cheeks and bobbed his head.
He was smarter than any of us.
I know. He told me this thing, that it was a program, one that made very detailed images, like the images we see of the outside. She waited a beat to see how he would respond. It was taboo to even use the word in most settings. Walker was unmoved. As she had hoped, he was old enough to be beyond childhood fears, and probably lonely and sad enough not to have cared anyway. But this wire he sent, it says something about PXLs being too dense? She showed him the copy she'd made. Walker grabbed his magnifiers and slipped the band over his forehead.
Pixels,
he said, sniffing.
He's talking about the little dots that make up an image. Each one is a pixel.
He took the note from her and read some more.
He says it's not safe there.
Walker rubbed his chin and shook his head.
Damn them!
Walker, what kind of screen would be 8 inches by 2 inches? Juliet looked around at all the boards, displays, and coils of loose wire strewn about his workshop. Do you have anything like that?
8 by 2? Maybe a readout, like on the front of a server or something. Be the right size to show a few lines of text, internal temps, clock cycles.
He shook his head.
But you'd never make one with this kind of pixel density. Even if it were possible, it wouldn't make sense. Your eye couldn't make out one pixel from its neighbor if it were right at the end of your nose.
He rubbed his stubble and studied the note some more.
What's this nonsense about the tape and the joke? What's that mean?
Juliet stood beside him and looked over the note. I've been wondering about that. He must mean the heat tape he scored for me a while back.
I think I remember something about that.
Well, do you remember the problems we had with it? The exhaust we wrapped in it almost caught fire. The stuff was complete crap. I think he sent a note asking if the tape had gotten here okay, and I sort of recall writing back that it did, and thanks, but the tape couldn't have self-destructed better if it had been engineered to.
That was a joke?
Walker swiveled in his stool and rested his elbows on the workbench. He kept peering over the copied charcoal letters like they were the face of Scotty, his little shadow coming back one last time to tell him something important. "And he says my joke was truth," Juliet said. "I've been up the last 3 hours thinking about this, dying to talk to someone." Walker looked back over his shoulder at her, his eyebrows raised. "I'm not a sheriff, Walk. Never born to be one. Shouldn't have gone. But I know, as sure as everyone, that what I'm about to say should set me to cleaning." Walker immediately slid off his stool and walked away from her. Juliet damned herself for coming, for opening her mouth, for not just clocking into first shift and saying to hell with it all. Walker shut the door to his workshop and locked it. He looked at her and lifted a finger, went to his air compressor and pulled out a hose. Then he flipped the unit on so the motor would start to build up pressure, which just leaked out the open nozzle in a steady, noisy hiss. He returned to the bench, the clatter from the noisy compressor engine awful, and sat down. His wide eyes begged her to continue. "There's a hill up there with a crook in it," she told him, having to raise her voice a little. "I don't know how long it's been since you've seen this hill, but there are two bodies nestled together in it, man and wife. If you look hard, you can see a dozen shapes like this all over the landscape. All the cleaners, all in various states of decay.
Most are gone, of course, rotted to dust over the long years. Walker shook his head at the image she was forming. How many years have they been improving these suits so the cleaners have a chance? Hundreds? He nodded. And yet nobody gets any further. And never once have they not had enough time to clean. Walker looked up and met her gaze.
Your joke is truth, he said. The heat tape, it's engineered to fail.
Juliet pursed her lips. That's what I'm thinking. But not just the tape. Remember those seals from a few years back? The ones from IT that went into the water pumps that were delivered to us by accident?
So we've been making fun of IT for being fools and dullards.
But we're the fools, Juliet said. And it felt so damned good to say it to another human being. So good for these new ideas of hers to swim in the air. And she knew she was right about the cost of sending wires. That they didn't want people talking. Thinking was fine. They would bury you with your thoughts. But no collaboration, no groups coordinating together, no exchange of ideas. You think they have us down here to be near the oil? She asked Walker. I don't think so. Not anymore. I think they're keeping anyone with a lick of mechanical sense as far from them as possible. There's two supply chains, two sets of parts being made, all in complete secrecy. And who questions them? Who would risk being put to cleaning?
You think they killed Scotty?
He asked. Juliet nodded. Walk? I think it's worse than that. She leaned closer, the compressor rattling, the hiss of released air filling the room. I think they kill everybody. 11. Juliet reported a first shift at 6, the conversation with Walker playing over and over in her head. There was a sustained and embarrassing applause from the handful of techs present as she entered dispatch. Knox just glared at her from the corner, back to his gruff demeanor. He had already welcomed her back, and damned if he'd do it again. She said hello to the people she hadn't seen the night before and looked over the job queue. The words on the board made sense, but she had a difficult time processing them. In the back of her mind, she thought about poor Scotty, confused and struggling while someone killed him. She thought of his little body, probably riddled with evidence but soon to feed the roots of the dirt farms. She thought of a married couple lying together on a hill, never given a chance to make it any further, to see beyond the horizon. She chose a job from the queue, one that would require little mental exertion on her part, and thought of poor Jean's and Marne's, how tragic their love, if she had been reading Marne's correctly, had been. The temptation to tell the entire room was crippling. She looked around at Megan and Rick's, at Jenkins and Mark, and thought about the small army of tight brotherhood she could form. The silo was rotten to the core. An evil man was acting mayor. A puppet stood where a good sheriff had been, and all the good men and women were gone. It was comical to imagine her rallying a band of mechanics to storm the upper levels and right a wrong. And then what? Was this the uprising they had learned about as children? Is this how it begins? One silly woman with fire in her blood stirring the hearts of a legion of fools? She kept her mouth shut and made her way to the pump room, riding the flow of morning mechanics, thinking more about what she should be doing above than on what needed repairing below. She descended one of the side stairwells, stopped by the tool room to check out a kit bag, and lugged the heavy satchel to one of the deep pits where pumps ran constantly to keep the deep silo from filling halfway up with water. Carol, a transfer from third shift, was already working near the pit basin, patching rotten cement. She waved with her trowel, and Juliet dipped her chin and forced herself to smile. The offending pump sat idle on one wall, the backup pump beside it struggling mightily and spraying water out of dry and cracked seals. Juliet looked into the basin to gauge the height of the water. A painted number 9 was just visible above its murky surface. Juliet did some quick math, knowing the diameter of the basin and it being almost 9 feet full. The good news was that they had at least a day before boots were getting wet. Worst case, they replace the pump with a rebuilt one from spares and deal with Hendrix bitching at them for checking it out instead of fixing what they already had. As she began stripping the failed pump down, pelted with spray from its smaller, leaking neighbor, Juliet considered her life with this new perspective provided by the morning's revelations. The silo was something she had always taken for granted. The priests say it had always been here, that it was lovingly created by a caring God, that everything they would ever need had been provided for. Juliet had a hard time with this story. A few years ago, she had been on the first team to drill past 10,000 feet and hit new oil reserves. She had a sense of the size and scope of the world below them, and then she had seen with her own eyes the view of the outside, with its phantom-like sheets of smoke they called clouds, rolling by on miraculous heights. She had even seen a star, which Lucas thought stood an inconceivable distance away. What god would make so much rock below and air above and just a measly silo between? And then there was the rotting skyline and the images in the children's books, both of which seemed to hold clues. The priests, of course, would say that the skyline was evidence that man wasn't supposed to exceed his bounds. And the books with the faded color pages? The fanciful imagination of authors, a class done away with for all the trouble they inspired. But Juliet didn't see fanciful imagination in those books. She had spent a childhood in the nursery, reading each one over and over whenever they weren't checked out, and things in them, and in the wondrous plays performed in the bazaar, made more sense to her than this crumbling cylinder in which they lived. She wiggled the last of the water hoses free and began separating the pump from its motor. The hint of steel shavings suggested a chewed-up impeller, which meant pulling the shaft. As she worked on automatic, cruising through a job she'd performed numerous times before, she thought back on the myriad of animals that populated those books, most of which had never been seen by living eyes. The only fanciful part, she figured, was that they all talked and acted human. There were mice and chickens in several of the books that performed these stunts as well, and she knew their breeds were incapable of speech. All those other animals must exist somewhere, or used to. She felt this to the core. Maybe because they weren't imaginative at all. Each seemed to follow the same plan, just like all the silos' pumps. You could tell one was based on the other. A particular design worked, and whoever had made one had made them all. The silo made less sense. It hadn't been created by a god. It was probably designed by IT. This was a new theory, but she felt more and more sure of it. They controlled all the important parts. Cleaning was the highest law and the deepest religion, and both of these were intertwined and housed within its secretive walls. And then there was the spacing from mechanical and the spread of the deputy stations. More clues. Not to mention the clauses in the pact that practically granted them immunity. And now the discovery of a second supply chain. A series of parts engineered to fail? A purpose behind the lack of progress in survival time on the outside. IT had built this place, and IT was keeping them there. Juliet nearly stripped a bolt, she was so agitated. She turned to look for Carol, but the younger woman was already gone, her repair patch a darker shade of gray as it waited to dry and blended in with the rest. Looking up, Juliet scanned the ceiling of the pump room where conduits of wire and piping traveled through the walls and mingled overhead. A run of steam pipes stood, clustered to the side to keep from melting any of the wires. A ribbon of heat tape hung off of one of these pipes in a loose coil. It would have to be replaced soon, she thought. That tape might be 10 or 20 years old. She considered the stolen tape that had caused so much of the mess she was in, and how it would have been lucky to survive 20 minutes up there. And that's when Juliet realized what she must do. A project to pull the wool back from everyone's eyes, a favor to the next fool who slipped up or dared to hope aloud. And it would be so easy. She wouldn't have to build anything herself. They would do all the work for her. All it would take would be some convincing, and she was mighty good at that. She smiled, a list of parts forming in her head as the broken impeller was removed from the faulty pump. All she would need to fix this problem was a replacement part or two. It was the perfect solution to getting everything in the silo working properly once more. Juliet worked two full shifts, wearing her muscles to a numb ache before returning her tools and showering. She worked a stiff brush under her nails over the bathroom sink, determined to keep them up top clean. She headed toward the mess hall, looking forward to a tall plate of high-energy food, rather than the weak rabbit stew from the cafeteria on level one, when she passed through Mechanical's entrance hall and saw Knox talking to Deputy Hank. The way they turned and stared, she knew they were talking about her. Juliet's stomach sank. Her first thought was of her father. And then Peter. Who else could they take away from her that she might care about? They wouldn't know to contact her about Lucas, whatever he was to her. She made a swift turn and headed their direction, even as the two of them moved to intercept her. The looks on their faces confirmed every fear. Something awful had happened. Juliet barely noticed Hank reaching for his cuffs.
"I'm sorry, Jules," he said as they got close.
"What happened?" Juliet asked. "Dad?"
Hank's brow wrinkled in confusion. Knox was shaking his head and chewing on his beard. He studied the deputy like he might eat the man.
"Knox, what's going on?"
"Jules, I'm sorry."
He shook his head. He seemed to want to say more but was powerless to do so. Juliet felt Hank reaching for her arm.
"You are under arrest for grave crimes against the silo."
He recited the lines like they were from a sad poem. The steel clinked around her wrist.
"You will be judged and sentenced according to the pact."
Juliet looked up at Knox. "What is this?" she asked. "Was she really being arrested again?"
"If you are found guilty, you will be given a chance at honor."
"What do you want me to do?"
Knox whispered, his vast muscles twitching beneath his coveralls. He wrung his hands together, watching the second metal band clack around her other wrist, her two hands shackled together now. The large head of Mechanical seemed to be contemplating violence, or worse.
"Easy, Knox," Juliet said.
She shook her head at him. The thought of more people getting hurt because of her was just too much to bear.
"Should humanity banish you from this world,"
Hank continued to recite, his voice cracking, his eyes wet with shame.
"Let it go," Juliet told Knox.
She looked past him to where more workers were coming off second shift, stopping to see this spectacle of their prodigal daughter being put in cuffs.
"In that banishment, you may find your sins scrubbed away,"
Hank concluded. He looked up at her, one hand gripping the chain between her wrists, tears streaking down his face.
"I am sorry,"
he said. Juliet nodded to him. She set her teeth and nodded to Knox as well.
"It's all right," she said. She kept bobbing her head. "It's all right, Knox. Let it go."
12. The climb up was to take 3 days. Longer than it should have, but there were protocols. A day trip up to Hank's office, a night in his cell. Deputy Marsh coming down the next morning from the mids to escort her up 50 levels to his office. She felt numb during this second day of climbing, the looks from passers-by sliding off her like water on grease. It was difficult to concern herself with her own life. She was too busy tallying all the lives that had been lost, some of them because of her. Marsh, like Hank, tried to make small talk, and all Juliet could contemplate to say in return was that they were on the wrong side, that evil ran amok, but she kept her mouth shut. At the Mids deputy station, she was shown to a familiar enough cell, just like the one in Hank's. No wall screen, just a stack of primed cinder blocks. She collapsed onto the bunk before he even had the gate locked and lay there for what felt like hours. waiting for night to come and pass to dawn, for Peter's new deputy to come and march her up the last leg of her journey. She checked her wrist often, but Hank had confiscated her watch. He probably wouldn't even know how to wind it. The thing would eventually fall into disrepair and return to being a trinket, a useless thing worn upside down for its pretty band. This saddened her more than it should have. She rubbed her bare wrist, dying to know the time, when Marsh came back and told her she had a visitor. Juliet sat up on the cot and swung her legs around. Who would come up to the mids from mechanical? When Lucas appeared on the other side of the bars, the dam that held back all her emotions nearly broke. She felt her neck constrict, her jaws ache from fighting the sobs. The emptiness in her chest nearly puncture and burst. He grabbed the bars and leaned his head against them, his temples touching the smooth steel, a sad smile on his face.
"Hey," he said.
Juliet barely recognized him. She was used to seeing him in the dark, had been in a hurry when they'd bumped into each other on the stairs. He was a striking man, his eyes older than his face, his light brown hair slicked back with sweat from what she assumed was a hurried walk down.
"You didn't need to come," she said, speaking softly and slowly to keep from crying.
What really saddened her was someone seeing her like this, someone she was beginning to realize she cared about. The indignity was too much.
"We're fighting this," he said. "Your friends are collecting signatures. Don't give up."
She shook her head. "It won't work," she told him. "Please don't get your hopes up."
She walked to the bars and wrapped her hands a few inches below his.
"You don't even know me."
"I know this is rat shit."
He turned away, a tear streaking down his cheek.
"Another cleaning?" he croaked. "Why?"
"It's what they want," Juliet said. "There's no stopping them."
Lucas's hand slid down the bars and wrapped around hers. Juliet couldn't free them to wipe at her cheeks. She tried to dip her head to use her shoulder.
"I was coming up to see you that day."
Lucas shook his head and took a deep breath.
"I was coming to ask you out."
"Don't," she said. "Lucas, don't do this."
"I told my mom about you."
"Oh, for God's sakes, Lucas."
"This can't happen," he said.
He shook his head.
"It can't. You can't go."
When he looked back up, Juliet saw that there was more fear in his eyes than even she felt. She wiggled one hand free and peeled his other one off. She pushed them away.
"You need to let this go," she said. I'm sorry. Just find someone. Don't end up like me. Don't wait."
"I thought I had found someone," he said plaintively.
Juliet turned to hide her face.
"Go," she whispered.
She stood still, feeling his presence on the other side of those bars, this boy who knew about stars but nothing about her. And she waited, listening to him sob while she cried quietly to herself, until she finally heard his feet shuffle across the floor, his sad gait carrying him away. That night, she spent another evening on a cold cot, another evening of not being told what she'd been arrested for, an evening to count the hurts she had unwittingly caused. The next day, there was a final climb up through a land of strangers, the whispers of a double cleaning chasing after her, Juliet falling into another stunned trance, one leg moving and then the other. At the end of her climb, she was moved into a familiar cell, past Peter Billings and her old desk. Her escort collapsed into Deputy Marnes's squeaking chair, complaining of exhaustion. Juliet could feel the shell that had formed around her during the long 3 days, that hard enamel of numbness and disbelief. People didn't talk more softly, they just sounded that way. They didn't stand further from her, they just seemed more distant. She sat on the lone cot and listened to Peter Billings charge her with conspiracy. The data drive hung in a limp plastic bag like a pet fish that had gobbled all its water and now lay dead. Dug out of the incinerator, somehow. Its edges were blackened. A scroll was unspooled, only partly pulped. Details of her computer search were listed. She knew most of what they found was Holston's data, not hers. She wasn't sure what the point would be of telling them this. They already had enough for several cleanings. A judge stood beside Peter in his black coveralls while her sins were listed, as if anyone were really there to decide her fate. Juliet knew the decision had already been made, and by someone else. Scotty's name was mentioned, but she didn't catch the context. It could have been that the email on his account had been discovered. It could be that they were going to pin his death on her, just in case. Bones buried with bones, keeping the secrets held between them safe. She tuned them out, and instead watched over her shoulder as a small tornado formed on the flats and spun toward the hills. It eventually dissipated as it crashed into the gentle slope, dissolving like so many cleaners, thrown to the caustic breeze and left to waste away. Bernard never showed himself. Too afraid or too smug, Jules would never know. She peered down at her hands, at the thin trace of grease deep under her nails, and knew that she was already dead. It didn't matter, somehow. There was a line of bodies behind and before her. She was just the shuffling present, the cog in the machine, spinning and gnashing its metal teeth until that one gear wore down, until the slivers of herself broke loose and did more damage, until she needed to be pulled, cast off, and replaced with another. Pam brought her oatmeal and fried potatoes from the cafeteria, her favorite. She left it steaming outside the bars. Notes were ported up from mechanical all day and passed through to her. She was glad none of her friends visited. Their silent voices were more than enough. Juliet's eyes did the crying, the rest of her too numb to shake or sob. She read the sweet notes while tears dripped on her thighs. Knox's was a simple apology. She imagined he would rather have murdered and done something, even if he were cast out for the attempt, than the impotent display his note said he would regret all his life. Others sent spiritual messages, promises to see her on the other side, quotes from memorized books. Shirley maybe knew her best, and gave her an update on the generator and the new centrifuge for the refinery. She told her all would remain well, and largely because of her. This elicited the faintest of sobs from Juliet. She rubbed the charcoal letters with her fingers, transferring some of her friend's black thoughts to herself. She was left at last with Walker's note, the only one she couldn't figure. As the sun set over the harsh landscape, the wind dying down for the night and allowing the dust to settle, she read his words over and over, trying to deduce what he meant.
"Jules, no fear. Now is for laughing. The truth is a joke, and they're good in supply. Walk."
She wasn't sure how she fell asleep, only that she woke up and found notes like peeled chips of paint around her cot. More of them slipped between the bars overnight. Juliet turned her head and peered through the darkness, realizing someone was there. A man stood behind the bars. When she stirred, he pulled away, a wedding band singing with the sound of steel on steel. She rose hurriedly from the cot and rushed to the bars on sleepy legs. She grabbed them with trembling hands and peered through the darkness as the figure melded with the black.
"Dad!" she called out, reaching through the grate.
But he didn't turn. The tall figure hurried his pace, slipping into the void, a mirage now, as well as a distant childhood memory. The following sunrise was something to behold. There was a rare break in the low, dark clouds that allowed visible rays of golden smoke to slide sideways across the hills. Juliet lay in her cot, watching the dimness fade to light, her cheek resting on her hands, the smell of cold, untouched oatmeal drifting from outside the bars. She thought of the men and women in IT, working through the past 3 nights to construct a suit tailored for her, their blasted parts ported up from supply. The suit would be timed to last her just long enough to get her through the cleaning, but no further. In all the ordeal of her handcuffed climb, the days and nights of numb acceptance, the thought of the actual cleaning had never occurred to her until now, on the very morning of that duty. She felt, with absolute certainty, that she would not perform the act. She knew they all said this, every cleaner, and that they all experienced some magical, perhaps spiritual, transformation on the threshold of their deaths and performed nonetheless. But she had no one up top to clean for. She wasn't the first cleaner from mechanical, but she was determined to be the first to refuse. She said as much as Peter took her from her cell and led her to that yellow door. A tech from IT was waiting inside, making last-minute adjustments to her suit. Juliet listened to his instructions with a clinical detachment. She saw all the weaknesses in the design. She realized, if she hadn't been so busy working 2 shifts in mechanical to keep the floods out, the oil in, the power humming, that she could make a better suit in her sleep. She studied washers and seals identical to the kind employed in pumps, but designed, she knew, to break down. The shiny coat of heat tape, applied in overlapping strips to form the skin of the suit, she knew to be purposefully inferior. She nearly pointed these things out to the tech as he promised her the latest and greatest. He zipped her up, tugged on her gloves, helped with her boots, and explained the numbered pockets. Juliet repeated the mantra from Walker's note. No fear, no fear, no fear. No fear, no fear, no fear. Now is for laughing. The truth is a joke, and they are in good supply. The tech checked her gloves and the Velcro seals over her zippers while Juliet puzzled over Walker's note. Why had he capitalized supply? Or was she even remembering it correctly? Now she couldn't remember. A strip of tape went around one boot, then the other. Juliet laughed at the spectacle of it all. It was all so utterly pointless. They should bury her in the dirt farms where her body might actually do some good. The helmet came last, handled with obvious care. The tech had her hold it while he adjusted the metal ring collar around her neck. She looked down at her reflection in the visor, her eyes hollow and so much older than she remembered, yet so much younger than she felt. Finally, the helmet went on, the room dimmer through the dark glass. The tech reminded her of the argon blast, of the fires that would follow. She would have to get out quickly or die a far worse death inside. He left her to consider this. The yellow door behind her clanged shut, its wheel spun on the inside as if by a ghost. Juliet wondered if she should simply stay and succumb to the flames, not give this spiritual awakening a chance to persuade her. What would they say in mechanical when the tail spiraled its way through the silo? Some would be proud of her obstinacy, she knew. Some would be horrified at her having gone out that way, in a bone-charring inferno. A few might even think she'd not been brave enough to take the first step out the door, that she'd wasted the chance to see the outside with her own eyes. Her suit crinkled as the argon was pumped into the room, creating enough pressure to temporarily hold the outside toxins at bay. She found herself shuffling toward the door, almost against her will. When it cracked, the plastic sheeting in the room flattened itself against every pipe, against the low-jutting bench, and she knew the end had come. The doors before her parted, the silo splitting like the skin of a pea, giving her a view of the outside through a haze of condensing steam. One boot slid through that crack, followed by another. And Juliet moved out into the world, dead set on leaving it on her own terms, seeing it for the first time with her own eyes, even through this limited portal, this roughly 8-inch by 2-inch sheet of glass, she suddenly realized. 13. Bernard watched the cleaning from the cafeteria while his techs gathered their supplies in Peter's office. It was his habit to view these things alone. His techs rarely joined him. They lugged their equipment out of the office and headed straight for the stairwell. Bernard was ashamed sometimes of the superstitions, the fears he fostered even in his own men. First, the dome of her helmet, and then the shiny specter of Juliet Nichols staggered above ground. She lumbered up the ramp, her movements stiff and unsure. Bernard checked the clock on the wall and reached for his cup of juice. He settled back to see if he could gauge another cleaner's reaction to what they were seeing. A world crisp, bright, and clean, studded with soaring life, grass wavering in a fresh breeze, a glimmering acropolis beckoning from over the hills. He had watched nearly a dozen cleanings in his day, always enjoying that first pirouette as they took in their surroundings. He had seen men who had left families behind dance before the censors, waving their loved ones out, trying to pantomime all the false goodness displayed on their visor screens, all to no avail, to no audience. He had seen people reaching madly for flying birds, mistaking them for insects much closer to their faces. One cleaner had even gone back down the ramp and presumably beat on the door as if to signal something before finally getting to cleaning. What were any of these various reactions but the proud reminder of a system that worked? That no matter the individual psychology, the sight of all their false hopes eventually drove them to do what they promised they wouldn't. Perhaps that's why Mayor Jeanne's could never stomach to watch. She had no idea what they were seeing, feeling, responding to. She would come up with her weak stomach the next morning and take in a sunrise, mourn in her own way, the rest of the silo granting her some space. But Bernard cherished this transformation, this delusion he and his predecessors had honed to perfection. He smiled and took a sip of fresh fruit juice and observed this Juliet as she staggered around, coming to her misguided senses. There was the barest coat of grime on the sensor lenses, not even worth a hard scrub, but he knew from double cleanings in the past that she would do it anyway. No one had ever not. He took another sip and turned to the sheriff's office to see if Peter had summoned the courage to come watch, but the door was closed all but a crack. He had high hopes for that boy. Sheriff today, and maybe one day mayor. Bernard might hold the post for a short while, maybe an election or two, but he knew he belonged in IT, that this was not the job for him. Or rather, that his other duties were far more difficult to replace. He turned away from Peter's office and back to the view, and nearly dropped his plastic cup of juice. The silvery form of Juliet Nichols was already trudging up the hill. The grime on the sensors was still in place. Bernard stood abruptly, knocking his chair over backwards. He staggered toward the wall screen, almost as if he could chase after her. And then he watched, dumbfounded, as she strode up that dark crease and paused for a moment over the still form of two other cleaners. Bernard checked the clock again. Any moment now. Any moment. She would collapse and fumble for her helmet. She would roll in the dusty soil, kicking up a cloud, sliding down that slope until she came to a dead rest. But the second hand ticked along, and so did Juliet. She left the two cleaners behind, her limbs still climbing with power, her steady gait guiding her far up to the crest of the hill where she stood, taking in a view of who knew what, before disappearing, impossibly, out of sight. Bernard's hand was sticky with juice as he raced down the stairwell. He kept the crushed plastic cup in his fist for 3 levels before catching up to his techs and hurling it at their backs. The ball of trash bounced off and went tumbling into space, destined to settle on some distant landing below. Bernard cursed the confused men and kept running, his feet dangerously close to tripping over themselves. 12 floors down, he nearly collided with the first hopeful climbers ascending to see the second crisp sunrise in the past weeks. He was sore and winded when he finally made it down to 34, his spectacles sliding around on the sweaty bridge of his nose. He burst through the double doors and yelled for the gate to be opened. A frightened guard complied, scanning the reader with his own ID right before Bernard slammed through the stubby metal arm. He practically ran down the hallway, taking 2 turns before he got to the most heavily fortified door in the entire silo. Swiping his card and punching in his security code, he hurried inside, past the thick wall of solid steel. It was hot in the room full of servers. The identical black cases rose from the tiled floor like monuments to what was possible, to the craft and engineering of human endeavor. Bernard walked among them, the sweat gathering in his eyebrows, light glittering in his vision, his upper lip wet with perspiration. He ran his hands along the faces of the machines, the flashing lights like happy eyes trying to soothe his anger, the electrical hum like whispers to their master, hoping to calm him. None of it worked. Bernard felt a surge of fear. He went over and over what could have gone wrong. It wasn't as if she would survive. She couldn't possibly survive, but his mandate, second only to preserving the data on these machines, was to never let anyone out of sight. It was the highest order. He didn't have to know why to tremble from the morning's failure. He cursed the heat as he reached the server on the far wall. The vents overhead carried cool air from the down deep and deposited it into the server room. Large fans in the back whisked the heat away and pumped it through more ducts down the silo, keeping the cool and dingy nastiness of the triple-digit levels humanely warm. Bernard glared at the vents, remembering the power holiday, the week of rising temperatures that had threatened his servers, all for some generator, and all because of this woman he had just let out of his sight. The memory stoked the flames under his collar. He cursed the design flaw that left the control of those vents down in mechanical with those grease monkeys, those uncivilized tinkerers. He thought of the ugly and loud machines down there, the smell of leaking exhaust and burning oil. He had only needed to see it once, to kill a man, but even that was too much. Comparing those noisy engines with the sublime servers was enough to make him never want to leave IT. Here was where silicone chips released their tangy scent as they heated under the strain of crunching data. Here was where one could smell the rubber coating the wires, running in parallel, neatly bundled, labeled, and coded, and streaming with gigabits of glorious data every second. Here was where he oversaw the refilling of their data drives with all that had been deleted from the last uprising. Here a man could think, surrounded by machines quietly doing the same. Somewhere down those vents, however, was the stench of the unclean. Bernard wiped the sweat from his head and rubbed it on the seat of his coveralls. The thought of that woman, first stealing from him, then rewarded by Jeans with the highest office of law, and now daring to not clean, to wander off, it raised his temperature dangerously. He reached the server at the end of the row and squeezed between it and the wall to the back. The key kept around his neck slid into the greased innards of the case locks. As he turned each one, he reminded himself that she couldn't have gotten far. And how much trouble could this really cause? More importantly, what had gone wrong? The timing should always be impeccable. It always had been. The back of the server came free, revealing the mostly empty innards behind. Bernard slipped the key back into his coveralls and set the panel of black steel aside, the metal damnably hot to the touch. There was a cloth case fastened inside the server's belly. Bernard loosened the flap and reached inside, extracting the plastic headset. He pulled it down over his ears, adjusted the mic, and unspooled the cord. He could keep this under control, he thought to himself. He was head of IT. He was mayor. Peter Billings was his man. People liked stasis, and he could maintain the illusion of it. They were afraid of change, and he could conceal it. With him in both offices, who would oppose him? Who was better qualified? He would explain this. Everything would be okay. Still, he was mightily, uniquely afraid as he located the correct jack and plugged in the cord. There was an immediate beeping sound in the headphones, the connection automatically taking place. He could still oversee IT from a distance, make sure this never happened again, be more on top of his reports. Everything was under control. He told himself this as the headphones clicked and the beeping stopped. He knew someone had picked up, even if they refused anything in the way of a greeting. He felt there was annoyance hanging in the silence. Bernard dispensed with the pleasantries as well. He jumped right into what he needed to say.
Silo 1, this is Silo 18.
He licked the sweat off his lips and adjusted his mic. His palms suddenly felt cold and clammy, and he needed to pee.
We might have a, slight problem over here.
Wool, Part 4. The Unraveling. The Tragic History of Romeus and Juliet. The walk was long, and longer still for her young mind. Though Juliet took few of the steps with her own small feet, it felt as though she and her parents had traveled for weeks. All things took forever in impatient youth, and any kind of waiting was torture. She rode on her father's shoulders, clutched his chin, her legs wrapped, choking around his neck. Riding so high, she had to stoop her head to avoid the undersides of the steps. Clangs from strangers' boots rang out on the treads above her, and sprinkles of rust dust drifted into her eyes. Juliet blinked and rubbed her face into her father's hair. As excited as she was, the rise and fall of his shoulders made it impossible to stay awake. When he complained of a sore back, she rode a few levels on her mother's hip, fingers interlocked around her neck, her young head lolling as she drifted off to sleep. She enjoyed the sounds of the traveling, the footfalls and the rhythmic song of her mother and father chatting adult things, their voices drifting back and forth as she faded in and out. The journey became a haze of foggy recollections. She awoke to the squealing of pigs through an open door, was vaguely aware of a garden they toured, woke fully to the smell of something sweet, and ate a meal, lunch or dinner, she wasn't sure. She hardly stirred that night as she slid from her father's arms into a dark bed. She awoke the next morning beside a cousin she didn't know in an apartment nearly identical to her own. It was a weekend. She could tell by the older kids playing loudly in the hallway instead of getting ready for school. After a cold breakfast, she returned to the stairs with her parents and the sensation that they'd been traveling all their lives instead of just one day. And then the naps returned with their gentle erasure of time. What took 2 days and felt like a week or a month to young Juliet finally brought them to the 100th landing of the silo's unfathomable depths. She took the last steps herself, her mom and dad holding a hand each, telling her the significance. She was now in a place called the Down Deep, they told her, the bottom third. They steadied her sleepy legs as she wobbled from the last tread of the 99th stairway to the landing of the 100th. Her father pointed above the open and busy doors to a large, painted number with an incredible third digit. 100. The two circles captivated Juliet. They were like wide-open eyes peering out at the world for the first time. She told her father that she could already count that high.
"I know you can," he said. "It's because you're so smart."
She followed her mother into the bazaar while clutching one of her father's strong and rough hands with both of her own. There were people everywhere. It was loud, but in a good way. A happy noise filled the air as people lifted their voices to be heard, just like a classroom once the teacher was gone. Juliet felt afraid of getting lost, and so she clung to her father. They waited while her mom bartered for lunch. It required stopping at what felt like a dozen stalls to get the handful of things she needed. Her dad talked a man into letting her lean through a fence to touch a rabbit. The fur was so soft it was like it wasn't there. Juliet snapped her hand back in fear when the animal turned its head, but it just chewed something invisible and looked at her like it was bored. The bazaar seemed to go on forever. It wound around and out of sight, even when all the many-colored adult legs were clear enough for her to see to the end. Off to the sides, narrower passages full of more stalls and tents twisted in a maze of colors and sounds, but Juliet wasn't allowed to go down any of these. She stuck with her parents until they arrived at the first set of square steps she'd ever seen in her young life.
"Easy now," her mother told her, helping her up the steps.
"I can do it,"
she said stubbornly, but took her mom's hand anyway.
"Two and one child," her father said to someone at the top of the steps.
She heard the clatter of chits going into a box that sounded full of them. As her father passed through the gate, she saw the man by the box was dressed in all colors, a funny hat on his head that flopped, much too big. She tried to get a better look as her mom guided her through the gates, a hand on her back and whispers in her ear to keep up with her father. The gentleman turned his head, bells jangling on his hat, and made a funny face at her, his tongue poking out to the side. Juliet laughed, but still felt half afraid of the strange man as they found a spot to sit and eat. Her dad dug a thin bedsheet out of his pack and spread it across one of the wide benches. Juliet's mom made her take her shoes off before she stood on the sheet. She held her father's shoulder and looked down the slope of benches and seats toward the wide open room below. Her father told her the open room was called a stage. Everything in the down deep had different names.
"What are they doing?"
she asked her father. Several men on the stage, dressed as colorfully as the gatesmen, were throwing balls up into the air, an impossible number of them, keeping them all from hitting the ground. Her father laughed.
"They're juggling. They're here to entertain us until the play starts."
Juliet wasn't sure she wanted the play to start. This was it, the thing she wanted to see. The jugglers tossed balls and hoops between each other, and Juliet could feel her own arms windmilling as she watched. She tried counting the hoops, but they wouldn't stay in one place long enough.
"Eat your lunch," her mother reminded her, passing her bites of a fruit sandwich. Juliet was mesmerized. When the jugglers put the balls and hoops away and started chasing one another, falling down and acting silly, she laughed as loudly as the other kids. She looked constantly to her mom and dad to see if they were watching. She tugged on their sleeves, but they just nodded and continued to talk, eat, and drink. When another family sat close and a boy, older than her, laughed at the jugglers as well, Juliet felt suddenly like she had company. She began to squeal even louder. The jugglers were the brightest things she had ever seen. She could have watched them forever. But then the lights were dimmed and the play began, and it was boring by comparison. It started off nice with a rousing sword fight, but then it was a lot of strange words and a man and woman looking at each other the way her parents did, talking in some funny language. Juliet fell asleep. She dreamed of flying through the silo with 100 colorful balls and hoops soaring all around her, always out of reach, the hoops round like the numbers at the end of the bazaar's level, and then she woke up to whistles and applause. Her parents were standing and yelling while the people on the stage and the funny costumes took several bows. Juliet yawned and looked over at the boy on the bench beside her. He was sleeping with his mouth open,
his head in his mom's lap, his shoulders shaking while she clapped and clapped. They gathered up the sheet, and her father carried her down to the stage where the sword fighters and strange talkers were speaking to the audience and shaking hands. Juliet wanted to meet the jugglers. She wanted to learn how to make the hoops float in the air. But her parents waited instead until they could speak to one of the ladies, the one who had her hair braided and twisted into drooping curves.
"Juliet," her father told her, lifting her onto the stage, "I want you to meet Juliet."
He gestured to the woman in the fluffy dress with the strange hair.
"Is that your real name?"
the lady asked, kneeling down and reaching for Juliet's hand. Juliet pulled it back like it was another rabbit about to bite her, but nodded.
"You were wonderful," her mom told the lady.
They shook hands and introduced themselves.
"Did you like the play?"
the lady with the funny hair asked. Juliet nodded. She could sense that she was supposed to, and that this made it okay to lie.
"Her father and I came to this show years ago when we first started dating," her mother said.
She rubbed Juliet's hair.
"We were going to name our first child either Romeus or Juliet."
"Well, be glad you had a girl then," the lady said, smiling.
Her parents laughed, and Juliet was beginning to be less afraid of this woman with the same name as her.
"Do you think we could get your autograph?"
Her father let go of her shoulder and rummaged in his pack.
"I have a program in here somewhere."
"Why not a script for this young Juliet?"
the lady smiled at her.
"Are you learning your letters?"